Hi, I'm Don West, National Trial Counsel for CCW Safe, a practicing criminal defense lawyer, board certified by the Florida Bar. I've been practicing over 35 years now. I'm joined here today by Sean Vincent, litigation consultant. Welcome, Sean. Nice to see you.
Thanks, Don. I've had an opportunity to consult on a number of self-defense cases, and on at least a couple of occasions had the good fortune to work with Don. Mm-hmm. And I've been writing a column for CCW Safe about the elements of self-defense, and not the legal elements of self-defense. That's something that you work with in court, but we've looked at a number of high-profile self-defense cases that have made the news over the last 10 years, we'll say. And we've discovered that there are certain elements, certain themes that are present in every self-defense case.
That's right. There are certain aspects of these cases, certain points of view, and certain commonalities that using as a starting point for analysis helps us better understand not only what happened, but maybe why it happened and why the outcome was what it was.
And most importantly, what the lessons are for a concealed carrier, mm-hmm. When you're making what may be the most important decision ever in your life, should you ever have to defend yourself with deadly force. So we've done some research. We've collected, by the time we're done with the project, 12 different high-profile self-defense cases, and we're looking at them with these common themes.
That's right.
And as an introduction to our conversation about these cases in specific, we'll talk about these broader concepts. Right. Mm-hmm. So here's what we got. Out of we call them the four elements of self-defense.
That's as easy as anything. Sure. The elements of self-defense, not to be confused with the strict legal elements, but because these are important, essential points of view, we'll call them the four elements of self-defense.
Well, let's say the average concealed carrier or someone who owns a gun with the idea of home protection isn't a lawyer. And these are practical terms that you can think about.
Exactly.
So here's what they are. We have location. Every self-defense shooting happens somewhere, and the location where that happens has a big bearing on how the justification for the shooting is.
It does, and it may directly affect the set of legal rules or the laws that apply in certain locations.
Sure, so we'll be talking about the Castle Doctrine, we'll be talking about stand your ground in the context of location. Mm-hmm. The next is escalation, right? A self-defense shooting happens as a result of a conflict or a confrontation that happens. And there are, in every self-defense shooting that we've looked at, there's an opportunity for both parties and our interest, the shooter, to either de-escalate the situation to make violence less likely, or things that sometimes happen where they escalate that encounter that makes a shooting more inevitable.
And I think that's critically important in a legal analysis, too. The jury may very well be asked at some point to decide who started it and who had the chance to walk away and didn't. And what are those not just human dynamics, but how they relate to legal issues that help set the stage for whether you had the legal right to defend yourself.
Sure, so the idea of the initial aggressor is something we're going to explore as we look through these cases. The third element that we look at is sort of central. It's the pivot for all these things, and this is the idea of fear or reasonable fear of imminent harm or even death to the shooter or other people, the shooter's family, for example.
That's right. Our context is going to be focusing on lethal self-defense cases, typically involving a firearm. And one of the critical turning points, as you said, was the person truly of the belief that they had to act right then? And did they not act right then, they would be seriously injured or killed? And was their assessment reasonable under all of the circumstances known to them? That's probably the jury's most critical point of analysis, this sort of umbrella of reasonableness. Because unlike most any other kind of criminal case, in a self-defense case, the jury is asked to step into the shoes of the defendant or the accused and see the events unfold as he or she did and make the same kinds of decisions underneath it all, whether the conduct was reasonable.
Right. Mm-hmm. And a term that we're going to end up seeing in a couple of these cases is the idea of, was it immediately necessary?
Exactly right.
And immediate and necessary are both critical elements to that.
Exactly right.
The fourth concept to look at is post-incident actions. And that goes to how quickly do you or someone else call 911, right? What do you say on that call? And when you encounter law enforcement, do you make statements to them? What do you say? Most of the cases we look at, the shooters felt justified immediately following the shooting, but they make the mistake of giving detailed statements to law enforcement without the advice of a lawyer. And very often, more often than not for sure, that comes to cause them big troubles when they get to trial.
Well, there's obviously and clearly two phases to a self-defense incident. The one is the actual act of defense, those events leading up to the decision to use deadly force. And then there is an aftermath. What happens at that point? If there's been a shooting, somebody is seriously injured or killed, law enforcement will certainly be involved. And then the focus shifts away from what happened at that moment to how is the person who had to defend himself or herself against a lethal attack going to be viewed by the system. Because that perception will drive, in large part, the conduct of law enforcement, perhaps.
Sure.
There's a lot of subjectivity to some of that decision-making process. And then ultimately how the case is reviewed by the prosecuting authority, the district attorney, the state attorney, and ultimately in the hands of the jury. So what happens, what one does immediately after, their interactions with the police, things they say, perhaps more importantly what they don't say under the stress of the moment, become critically important in shaping what happens from the criminal justice system standpoint.
Yeah, so to give you guys a preview of the types of cases that we're going to be looking at, we've got them divided roughly into three trilogies, and then plus a few others that have some interesting context. But first, we'll be looking at Castle Doctrine cases. These are shootings that happened with intruders in people's homes. Then we're going to look at a trilogy of cases that involve motorists. Road rage, sometimes they're called, mm-hmm. or incidents mm-hmm. that happened while someone was in or immediately out of their car after right. An engagement on the road. And then we're going to look at cases that happen in public places.
Sure.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So.
And those elements that we've already identified now will play directly into each of those kinds of cases. And we hope, through this conversation, help illustrate and be somewhat informative and educational along the way as we discuss what happened in these individual cases, but extract lessons and learning points for those that are concealed carriers, those that may at some point in their life find themselves in a position where they have to defend their lives.
Right, so we're gonna have a lot of great lessons for concealed carriers, for homeowners' interest in self-defense. I'm Sean Vincent, this is Don West. We hope you'll join us as we explore these cases.
Thank you.